Good morning. Thank you for coming. Happy St. Patrick's Day. We have a nice lineup of story and song for you this morning. The morning's theme is the stories we tell. But first, I'd like to start with announcements, and I'd like to invite Ami up to do the announcements for this morning's service.
Good morning. I'm Ami Ledwell, and I am a member of the LGBTQIA plus task force. Good morning and welcome to the First Parish Church of Stowe and Acton, a welcoming Unitarian Universalist congregation. Our minister is the Reverend Dr. Cynthia Landrum, but today's service is being led by Michael Palladini. Everyone is invited to coffee hour in Fellowship Hall after the service. To get there, please exit the church through the door to my left. Follow the hallway to the end, go down the stairs, or take the elevator and follow the arrow to Fellowship Hall. Childcare is available during this service in the nursery. If the need arises anytime during the service, please feel free to take your child there where they will be well cared for. The nursery is located in the lower level of our Fellowship Hall, which you get to the same way as you get to Fellowship Hall, just down one more level. If you're not sure where to go, please ask one of our ushers and they will let you know where to go. On most Sundays, we have religious education classes that children depart for after the first part of the service, at the 9 a.m. service. There are usually more folks, but see the order of service for more information about today's program. If this is your first time with us, we are very happy to have you here. Please sign one of our guest books, which are located in the vestibule, and then also outside the door here or at the visitors' table at coffee hour, so we can put you on our mailing list for newsletter and announcements. I would like to call your attention to the announcements in today's order of service. In particular, I have been asked by the stewardship committee to remind you that the pledge forms are in the pews and online, so please feel free to make your pledges that way if you have not done so already. If you have already, thank you very much for your help. And lastly, we have a letter which Cindy has written to the FPC community that I am going to read at this point. In this month of our denominational magazine, UU World, published an article entitled After LG and B. Many of you will already have received the spring issue in the mail. The article in which the author, a cisgender woman, related her experiences with transgender and intersex people in her life, caused harm to transgender Unitarian Universalists. And the UU World has issued an apology for the article, which can be read on their website. The Transgender Religious Professional Unitarian Universalists Together group, which is called TRUST, sums up the issue with the article well in these words. The UU World's article, titled After LG and B, frames the trans experience by centering a white, heterosexual, cisgender woman's experience. By doing so, it reduces trans people to objects, something that happens far too often in society and in our UU communities. The use of harmful slurs, the conflation of intersex and trans experience, and a repeated focus on surgery, hormones, and pronouns perpetuate stereotypes about trans experiences that devalues the gifts that we have to bring to the world and Unitarian Universalism. Here at FPC, our goal is to support transgender people in our community and in the larger Unitarian Universalist Association. We are committed to responding to the TRUST call for action, also printed in the Spring UU World issue. In particular, we hear TRUST's call to engage in trans education and transformation as a congregation, and to take action as a congregation on our next steps towards increasing trans access, inclusion, and affirmation. As we do so, we ask our FPC community to do the following. Read both the article and the responses to it by trans UUs. In particular, we recommend the trust statement, CB Beal's response, and the blue response. And there are a bunch of links in the letter that you'll find in your order of service. Also, familiarize yourself with trans UUs and trans UU experiences by reading trust's recent report. Sorry, there is also a link for that report. Speak out on the issue yourself and amplify trans voices. Join the LGBTQ task force as we respond to Trust's call to action. If you have any questions about the article or the problems with it, we encourage you to reach out to our minister, who will be happy to discuss it with you. In faith, the FPC LGBTQ Task Force, the FPC Board of Trustees, and Cynthia Landrum, Minister. There is also a note here that says that cisgender is used to refer to someone whose gender identity aligns with the sex that they were assigned at birth. Transgender is used to refer to someone whose gender identity is not the same as the sex they were assigned at birth. That being said, it is now time to turn and greet your neighbor. You're welcome. Sure. I'm going to take stuff and get out of your way.
Thank you very much. Thank you. That was Watch What Happens by Michel Legrand. I believe it was from the movie The Umbrellas of Cherbourg. I'd like to do our call to worship, which is going to be our chalice lighting and covenant this morning. And if we can invite the Galena family up to light our chalice. Please rise as you are able for the chalice lighting and the affirmation. You can do it. Thank you. Love is the spirit of this church, and service its law. This is our great covenant, to dwell together in peace, to seek the truth in love, and to help one another. From all that dwell below the skies, let words of love and peace arise. Let joyful songs of praise be sung through every land by every tongue. Thank you. You may be seated.
All right, and I have a couple kids that offered to help me, so come on up, whoever, and if there's any other kids that want to come up and help, I can use some extra help. All right, I have two. That's a good start. Nell, are you interested? No? No? Okay. All right, so I have these kids, and I don't know what to do. I'm getting older, and I'm worried. I have a farm, and I need my children to help me on the farm, but all they do is argue with each other. They complain. They turn their backs on each other. And they won't work together. So I kept thinking and thinking, what can I do to help them learn the lesson that working together is better than being apart? So one day I call them and I say, children, come, come. And they're not talking to each other, and they're just being really ridiculous. And I give them a bunch of sticks, and I say, can you please break these sticks? Break them all in half, the whole bunch. Just by yourself, because you never work together. Now, will you try, please? And they're very strong, these children, but they can't do it. So then I ask them to take just one stick from the bunch and try to break that. Thank you. Can you break it? Oh, so individually you can break a single stick. So I thought maybe they could learn this lesson. That bundle of sticks is kind of like when you work together to work on the farm and to raise a happy family and to make a productive life, you're stronger. Just like that bundle of sticks is much stronger than these individual sticks. So I'm hoping that these children will take this message to heart and run a productive farm. Thank you very much. Now I want to take this one more step. So if we think about the sticks as a community, you can go ahead and sit down, thank you, and the individual sticks as individuals, as a community, we are much stronger working together. For example, I mentioned the auction. Now, the auction committee, if there was only one person on your committee, do you think that you could succeed in your auction? No. How about the orchestra? If you only had one instrument, do you think that would sound as beautiful and as wonderful? No. One instrument, though, sometimes for me, like if I can just hear a violin, I'm going to be transported. But together, the whole richness and depth of that music is brought up. How about, you know, stewardship is also often asking for donations. Now, can you imagine if just one person gave a pledge to the church? Could that sustain our church? Now, I asked Donna Lang, who's the head of the stewardship committee, and she's like, it would be a start. And that's true. But if only one person helped out, and it's hard financially to think, ooh, money, but together that always makes a difference. And our kids right now are doing service projects. And if, for example, there's a group doing baking, and they're going to have a bake sale in a couple weeks to help Chris Graberic in his quest to bring latrines to schools in Africa, in Ghana. And if only one kid did baking, they said they wouldn't get any baking done. And it's the same throughout so much of our community. So together, that's one of the things I appreciate about this community is how much we are a community. We're more like the bundle of sticks than the individual ones. And together, that makes for us to be a strong community. And on that note, our children are going to take, actually Corinne Murray's going to help us and take the light of our chalice to our religious education program where we'll continue to work on community projects together.
Kisa Gotami was a young woman from a prosperous family, and she was happily married to a wealthy man. A son was born to them, and Kisa Gotami loved her son with all her heart. But this son fell ill and died suddenly, when he was only a toddler. Kisa Gautami was stricken with grief. Her heart was broken. She wept for days on end. She could not endure the death of her only beloved child. Weeping constantly and near collapse, she took the body of her dead child and went everywhere asking for medicine to restore her son to life. People thought she had gone mad. But a wise man, seeing her pathetic condition, decided to send her to the Buddha. "Sister," he said, "the Buddha is the person you should see. He has the medicine you want. Go to him." Thus, she went to the Buddha and asked him to give her the medicine that would restore her dead son to life. The Buddha listened with patience and compassion. Then he told her, "There is a way to solve your problem. Please go and find me 4 or 5 mustard seeds from any family in which there has never been a death." Overjoyed at the prospect of having her son restored to life, Kisa Gautami ran from house to house, begging for some mustard seeds. Everyone was willing to help, but she could not find a single home where death had not occurred. "Kisa Gautami, I can give you mustard seeds, but I have lost a daughter." "Kisa Gautami, please take these seeds, but I have lost my brother." "Kisa Gautami, you are welcome to all that I have, but my mother died 10 days ago." Again and again, people were only too willing to part with their mustard seeds, but no one could claim to have never lost a loved one to death. As the day dragged on, she realized hers was not the only family that had faced death, and that there were far more people dead than living. Suddenly, she understood what the Buddha had wanted her to discover for herself, that suffering is a part of life, and death comes to us all. When Kisa Gautami accepted the fact that death is inevitable, she slowly began to return to her life. She took her beloved child's body away, burying her son and mourning her loss. She returned to the Buddha, dry-eyed and empty-handed, and told him that she could find no family where death had not occurred. Then the Buddha said, "Kisa Gautami, now you know that you are not the only one who has lost a son. As you now realize, death comes to all beings. Long before our desires are fulfilled, death takes us away."
Thank you, John. I like the phrase, she appeared before the Buddha, dry-eyed and empty-handed. I was told after the first service that my mic technique was bad. Can you hear me okay if I hold it here? Everybody can hear me all right? Is this all right? Okay, good. I'll try and remember to do that. So I'm going to tell the third story of the morning, which I believe comes out of the Muslim tradition. It's called The Story of the Pious Man. So there was a pious man, a farmer, a successful farmer, living centuries ago, and one day the angel of death appeared and said to him, "It's your time." And the pious man said, "Well, if it's God's will, then God's will be done. But for mercy's sake, I have 3 daughters. And my first daughter is, she's a bit of a simpleton. And I'd like to see her happily married before I die. And I wonder if I might be spared just to see that she's married." And the angel of death thought for a minute. He thought, "Well, I can give you a challenge, and if you successfully pass the challenge, then we'll assume it's God's will that you live a bit longer to see your daughter." So he said, the angel of death said, "Let me ask you a question." He said, "What gift did your mother leave by your head on the side of your pillow in your bed when you were 2 years old? If you can answer me that, you'll be spared." And then the angel of death went away and said he'd be back the next day. And so the man thought and thought, and he went to bed, and he couldn't imagine, you know, what the gift was. And he woke up the next morning, and he still didn't know the answer. And he was tending to his goats, and he was feeding them and so forth. And he asked the goats, he lamented to the goats, I don't know the answer to this question, and death will come today, and I'm just in despair. And the goats loved the man because he had always taken care of them and delivered their babies and taken the burrs out of their fur. And they said, oh, well, we know the answer to that question. Your mother left a hyacinth on your pillow when you were 2 years old. So later that day, death arrives, and the man answers, it was a hyacinth. And death praises God and disappears. And the man lives to help his oldest daughter find a simple but honest man, and they marry, and they live happily, and the man rejoices that he got to see his oldest daughter marry. And I feel compelled to do a little digression at this point. So this story comes from an era when the main thing about having daughters was getting them married. So work with me here. We know today that that's not the primary concern of parents of daughters. We know that daughters can, you know, be astronauts and lawyers and soldiers and chief justices and all kinds of wonderful things. In the United States, they apparently can't be president yet. We're not ready for that. We're not grown up enough for that yet. Maybe we'll get there, but most other occupations are available to young women today. So I digress. Let me go back to my story. So the angel of death appears a second time, sometime later, and he says, your time has come. And the man says, if it's God's will, so be it. But I have a second daughter, and she's kind of plain, and I'd really like to see her get married before I die. I'm a little worried that she'll find no husband. And the angel of death says, well, if you can answer this question, it must be God's will that you live. Let me ask you a second question. When you were 1 year old, what did your mother place in your mouth? And death disappears, death goes away, and he thinks about it, and he doesn't know. How do you remember what happened to you when you were 1 year old? And the next morning, he's taking care of his horses. He turns them out in the paddock. And he laments to his horses, I don't know, death will be coming today, and I don't know the answer to the question. And the horses say, oh, well, we know the answer to that question. Your mother placed a bit of boiled quail egg in your mouth when you were 1 year old. Sure enough, later that day, death appears, and the man answers the question, a bit of boiled quail egg. And the death praises God and disappears, and the man gets to see his second daughter married to a plain and simple man, but they're married happily and the man rejoices. You know where this is going. Time goes by. Death appears a third time. Says, it's your time. The man says, I have a third daughter and she's smart and beautiful and I'm sure she'll marry well, but I really would like to live to see her marry. And death says, well, if you can answer me this question, you'll be able to live. What did your mother whisper into your ear on the day that you were born? And the man, he doesn't know. He goes to bed, he's thinking about it, he wakes up in the morning, and he can't think. How are you supposed to remember what the very first words that your mother said to you on the day you were born? And he's feeding the chickens, and he asks the chickens, do you know? The horses knew, and the goats knew. Did the chickens know? And as everybody knows, chickens are kind of stupid. So they don't have any answer for him. They're just bark, 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 you know, just pecking the ground. And he's in despair, and to make matters worse, death arrives even earlier that day. He arrives later on in the morning, and he says, well, do you have an answer? And the man, his eyes are downcast. He doesn't know. And death says, do you have an answer? If not, you must come with me. And the man looks up with tears in his eyes, and he looks at death, and he says, only, I did not know that you would come so soon. And death says, God be praised, and disappears. For those were indeed the words that the man's mother whispered into his ear on the very moment that he was born. And so the man saw his third daughter married, and there was a big celebration, and he lived for many years in the blessings of his daughter and the bounty of his many grandchildren. Thank you. We have come to the portion of our service where we share our gifts. And this is a very generous congregation, and we thank you for your gifts to First Parish Church. I'd also like to call your attention to the fact that this month we share our weekly offering with the FPC guest table. Those of you that subscribe to FPC announcers see these announcements from Hector and the others that run this program. Once a month, we offer a meal to the community. Half the non-pledge offering of during the month of March will go to support FPC guest table. We appreciate your generosity. The morning's offering will be gratefully received. Thank you, everyone. So I'm only doing a homily at the 11 because we have a little bit more space in the 11. We're probably going to keep you a little long. I hope that's okay. At the end, we'll do our two postludes, and If you have to leave, it's okay. We won't be insulted. So I know sometimes people have places they got to be. It's already 5 of 12, and we're only at the homily. So Ecclesiastes chapter and verse 9:11, no less, reminds everyone that time and chance happeneth to them all. Our lives are filled with so much luck, both good and bad, more than we care to admit. Yet each of us can tell a coherent life story. Things happen to us, and then we make sense of what happened to us. We build a story around a sequence of inherently disconnected events. So, the randomness of life. Your niece gets pregnant, and 21 months later, her son is the ring bearer at the wedding of her and her son's dad. Your healthy, robust father is diagnosed with early-onset Alzheimer's and dies before his 64th birthday. You get a phone call out of the blue. Say yes, and your career changes for the better in ways you couldn't have possibly imagined. Your son suddenly becomes mentally ill. A distant uncle dies and remembers you in his will. Your wife develops pancreatic cancer and is dead 15 months later. You attend a party you were going to skip, meet someone, fall in love together, and marry within a year. As Phil's song title succinctly says, you came along and everything changed. All these events I just mentioned have happened to me or to people close to me. One story leads to another and another. The stories we tell condition the stories we can tell. Or, as the author David Trier put it, the ways in which we tell the story of our reality shapes that reality. The manner of telling makes the world both conceptually and actually. On the conceptual side, it's, this is what happened, this is how it made me feel, and this is what it meant to me. Last year, I reread Viktor Frankl's Man's Search for Meaning, and I highly recommend it. But this time, I found I had a slight quarrel with him, with the whole idea that meaning was something out there, something we seek. I don't believe meaning is in any way external or extrinsic. I believe we make meaning in our minds and hearts and then embody it in the world. Meanwhile, when we encounter instances of embodied meaning made by others, we interpret those markers and in so doing recreate meaning again within. Of course, frighteningly, if meaning is something that's made, created, then it is also something that can be destroyed. For example, between 507 and 554 AD, the faithful carved two giant, gorgeous Buddha statues into the sandstone cliffs at Bamiyan in Afghanistan. In 2001, the Taliban dynamited those statues, turning them into dust. Meaning makers and meaning destroyers. It seems strange to me that Frankl didn't acknowledge this. Take the central example of his book, The Nazi Death Camps. The Shoah said to the Jew, the gypsy, the gay person, the disabled, and the misfit, you do not matter. You have no story worth remembering. You're just a tattooed number. Since then, we have erected memorials to the victims of the Shoah, conducted rituals and ceremonies of remembrance. Acts such as these say, your lives did matter. You did not live in vain. We recreate the meaning, the mattering, that the Nazis tried to destroy. We tell a new story, a better story. Of course, it's not just actual stories, but any human endeavor that has narrative potential. We make meaning through poetry, music, painting, and as I mentioned, sculpture. And I don't mean to limit my examples only to art. Building a business, healing a sick person, teaching a child, and so on, all start new stories, forging and renewing meaning. But these acts and activities are meaningful because of the meaning that we give them and because we tell others about, that is, share that meaning. The sharing is very important. If you did something that left no trace, sang alone to the stars, danced solitary in the pouring rain, lay yourself face down on the earth and wept in the dark, and you told absolutely no one, wouldn't you come in time to doubt that it really had happened? Did I do it, or dream it. We need a friend to tell us, oh yeah, you told me about that. You were a little crazy back then. There are also larger stories that we tell, giant narratives. We believe in some comprehensive fictions, not falsehoods per se, but systems of meaning that we collectively accept. Three good examples are money, religion, and country. Money doesn't seem particularly fictitious. $100 buys $100 worth of stuff. Or at least it does until hyperinflation comes along, which is just another way of saying that the collective fiction has collapsed. No one accepts the story anymore, and $100 is suddenly worthless. A $100 bill becomes a green rectangular piece of paper with printing on it, which is what it really is after all. Its meaning has evaporated. How about religion? I've noticed that today, no one worships the gods on Mount Olympus. The Greek story grew old and ceased to be a living tale. Then those that come after call it myth or fiction. But I enjoy reading about the adventures of Zeus and Hera and Apollo and the rest, and find those stories meaningful in a different way. Now we can see the same thing starting with Christianity. Imagine Christianity in 1,000 years. Already, even the grand cathedrals of Europe are visited more by tourists than parishioners. There are more museums than houses of worship. What is God but just the greatest story we've ever told ourselves, our most enduring fairy tale? The God story is a story I believe in. It doesn't have to be true. To ask whether it's true is to ask the wrong question. It only has to be meaningful. Turning to country, we see how people will even lay down their lives for a story, a narrative that makes sense to them, that they invest with meaning. Hence, when 13 colonies rebel against the crown to start a new nation, the British send in the troops. Regardless, in 1776, a new story began and took hold. Later, during the American Civil War, the South tried to change the narrative again. But the Confederate States of America ended up being a rather short story, one only 51 months long. A handful of people still try to fly its flag, but face backlash from the majority of Americans saying, that's not the story we want to tell. That's not who we are. Which leads to my final point about the stories we tell. Stories form our identity. I've been meditating for over 2 years now under the guidance of Andrew Puddicombe. Andrew says that mindfulness is important because it makes us aware of the stories we tell ourselves over and over and over to shore up our shaky sense of self. What's fascinating is that this need causes us to cling to even painful narratives about our past that we would be better off without. Let me share a personal example. I was out for a walk not too long ago on a simply beautiful day, but I wasn't enjoying my surroundings or the present moment. I was rehearsing, a painful memory from when I was about 13 years old. My God, that was 50 years ago. And then I had a moment of mindfulness. Remember, I've been meditating. And I thought, why am I holding on to this? It shouldn't mean anything anymore. After all, most things just happen to us, and I let it go. It felt like freedom. It was an opening, a chance to write a new story. Abandon an unhappy narrative about yourself and watch what happens. There are facts. There are narratives about the facts. There are things that happen. And there are ways that we stitch together those events to tell a tale. I believe the material world itself is meaningless in the best sense of that word. It is our palette, our playground, the page on which we write the story of our lives. Out of the raw materials of life, we make meaning, saying, this matters. I matter. We matter. I'll close with the Virginian poet Gregory Orr, who put it beautifully in only 70 words. This is what was bequeathed us, the earth the beloved left and leaving left to us. No other world but this one, willows and the river and the factory with its black smokestacks. No other shore, only this bank on which the living gather. No meaning but what we find here. No purpose but what we make. That and the beloved's clear instructions. Turn me into story or song. Sing me awake. I'd like to invite our newest band member, Lindsay Lozo, up to tell a story from the Christian tradition. And we're very happy to have Lindsay. She's been with us since the beginning of the year as our new trumpeter. Lindsay?
Edges and Whispers. Once there was an old man who lived in a tiny village. Although poor, he was envied by all, for he owned a beautiful white horse, majestic, splendid, and strong. People offered fabulous prices for the steed, but the man always refused. "This horse is not a horse to me. He is a friend, not a possession. How could you sell a friend?" The temptation was great, but he never sold the horse. One morning, he found that the horse was not in the stable. All the village came to see him. "You old fool," they scoffed. "We warned that you would be robbed. How could you ever hope to protect such a valuable animal? It would have been better if you had sold him. You could have gotten whatever price you wanted. But now you've been cursed with misfortune." The old man responded, "Don't speak too quickly. All we know is that the horse is not in the stable. The rest is judgment. If I've been cursed, how can you know? How can you judge?" The people contested, "We may not be philosophers, but great philosophy is not needed. The simple fact is that your horse is gone, and that's a curse." The old man spoke again, "All I know is that the stable is empty and the horse is gone. The rest I don't know. I can't say whether it be a curse or a blessing. All we see is a fragment. Who can say what will come next?" The people of the village laughed. They always thought the man a fool. If he weren't, he would have sold the horse. But instead, he was a poor woodcutter, living hand to mouth in the misery of poverty. The man's horse returned after 15 days, having run away into the forest, and brought back with him a dozen wild horses. Once again, the people gathered around the man, saying, "Old man, you were right. We were wrong. What we thought was a curse was indeed a blessing." The man responded, "Once again, you go too far. Say only that the horse is back and with a dozen more horses, but don't judge. How can you know if this is a blessing or not? You see only a fragment. Life is so vast, yet you judge all of life with one page or one word. No one knows. Be content with what you know and not perturbed by what you don't." "Maybe the old man is right," they said to one another, so they said little. But down deep, they knew it was a blessing. The man now had 12 more horses. The animals could be broken and trained and sold for so much more money. The old man had only one son, who began to train the wild horses. And after a few days, he fell from one of them and broke both legs. Once again, the villagers gathered around the old man and cast their judgments. "You were right," they said. "You proved that you were right. The dozen horses were not a blessing. They were a curse. Your only son has broken his legs, and now in your old age you have no one to help you. Now you are even poorer than ever." The old man spoke again, "Don't go so far. Say only that my son broke his legs. Who knows if it's a blessing or a curse? No one knows. We can only have a fragment. Life comes in fragments." A few weeks later, the country engaged in war. All the young men of the village were required to join the army. Only the son of the old man was excluded because he was injured. Once again, the people gathered, crying because their sons had been taken with little chance that they would return. The enemy was strong. They might never see their sons again. "You were right, old man," they wept. "God knows you were right. This proves it. Your son's accident was a blessing. His legs may be broken, but at least he is with you. Our sons are gone forever." The old man spoke again. "Say only this. Your sons go to war, and mine did not. No one knows if it's a blessing or a curse. No one knows. Only God knows." The old man was right. We only have a fragment. Life's mishaps and horrors are only a page out of a single grand book. We must be slow about drawing conclusions. We must reserve judgment until we know the whole story.
Thank you. springtime, when is the October springtime?